where to begin about the Chanukah story? I'm sure most of you know the Chanukah story. We all know the Chanukah story. The only problem is that most of us, or many of us, I won't say most, but certainly many of us, encountered the Chanukah story for the first time in kindergarten. And that's more or less where it stayed until now. Once upon a time, there was a wicked king. His name was Antiochus. He didn't particularly like the Jews, and so he enforced upon them religious persecution. But the Jews would have nothing of this, and so they rose up in rebellion against him, and they were victorious. And that's why we light candles. And depending on whether you went, see, in Israel, I would say it would be, you know, Ganenet Malka or Rivka, right? Depending on who your kindergarten teacher was, that would decide when to put in the miracle of the 8 days of the oil lasting for 8 days instead of one day. In other words, we light candles for 8 days because they found a little tiny bit of oil, and that's why we have Chanukah. Now, I cannot...
The exact definition of a Jewish holiday. They try to kill us, one, let's eat.
Yes, but they light candles, but Chanukah being the exception where you light candles before you eat. Right, but then you make with it with this heavy, saturated fat food that I thankfully have not touched for years. There are all sorts of problems with that pat little story. And that's what I would like to do, is to put it into some sort of a context and to understand what of that story can we nevertheless sustain? What of that story, unfortunately, might be fancy rather than fact? Now, our perception of things that happened in the past are always shaped by a number of factors, by factors. One, the historical context, the facts on the site at the time. In other words, we want to assume, albeit this is the 21st century, we're in a postmodern world, but I think I told you this a year and a half ago, I'm from the old school of historians that still believes that things really happened once in the past, right? Concrete events, right? And that there was some sort of historical context in which they happened. So that is the one factor that shapes our perception, simply the event. The other factor are the sources that tell us about the events. In other words, if we know about them, it's not because we can simply turn on our TVs and plug into history, but there were conduits, there were all sorts of people and books that were produced along the way that told the story about the events, and we can read those books. Added to those sources, there are ideologies, agendas that attach themselves to the events, and they also shape our perception. Now, what are the differences between the facts, the sources, and the ideologies and agendas? We like to believe that facts are objective. Facts are facts, right? If we can arrive at what really happened, then we know this is the way it happened. Sources we know were produced by human beings. And human beings tend to see things in particular ways. And so the objectivity kind of loses some of its, some of its potency. Or it very often, when a person sits down to write the story of the Hasmoneans, let's say, or of the Maccabee, right? Objectivity might not always be the dominant factor in writing about the events. So I would say that sources can be, you know, quasi-objective. When we get to ideologies and to agendas, they are never objective, right? That's when objectivity takes a back seat, right, to all sorts of other needs, wishes, desires, religious perceptions. And what we have to do is to cut through all of these three and see what was it that shaped our image of the events, right? What are we willing to embrace from that, and what are we willing to take with more grain of salt? That's really what we have before us today. Okay. Now, that pat little story that I opened with, the kindergarten version of Chanukah, as it were, which unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, no, I would never put down the kindergarten version of anything, because it's what sustained us for many years and many, many generations, right? And there's something good in that. But there are all sorts of problems. For instance, once upon a time, there was an evil king, and he didn't like the Jews, and he was a Greek, right? And so he tried to force us to embrace Greek religion. There's a logical problem, not only a historical problem, but a simple presentation, and that is that the Hellenistic world, the world of Antiochus Epiphanes, and we'll talk about the dates in a few minutes, the Hellenistic world was a polytheistic world. It believed in many gods. The nature of a belief in many gods already suggests a somewhat tolerant society. That is to say, if you can get along with X number of gods, you can get along with X plus one. In other words, what are the societies in the ancient world or the late ancient world that would tend to be intolerant, right? Societies and religions that are monotheistic. In other words, say there is only one God, Ein od milvado, and there's none other than him, then clearly you cannot accept the existence of another deity. Now, of course, you have to distinguish between different types of monotheists. There are weak monotheists, right, that simply can't put into effect their belief in one God, and there are strong monotheists, right? For instance, beginning in the 4th century, when Constantine the Emperor brings about this marriage of power with religion, the Roman Empire and the Christian religion, that's when monotheism became a powerful entity and could try, at least, to impose its will on others. But the fact is that the ancient polytheistic world very rarely, and certainly the Greco-Roman world, rarely tries to impose its religious practice on others unless this was part of a punitive measure. That is to say, if people did something that aroused the ire of Rome, then they might react. But the kindergarten story does not project Antiochus as reacting to something. The kindergarten story of Hanukkah simply projects him as being a bad person who tried to impose his will on the Jews. That won't work. That won't work because it doesn't fit our knowledge of how the ancient Greek world functioned. But let's go a step further. Very often we are told, why did Hanukkah break out, or why did the Maccabean uprising break out? Because we have two cultures here. We have Judaism and we have Hellenism, and the two are on a collision course, right? The two simply are mutually exclusive, cannot get along together. Now, that would be nice were it not for the facts, right? What are the facts? The land of Israel and the vast majority of Jews in the world came under Hellenistic rule in the year 332 when Alexander the Great conquered the land of Israel. He actually marched through the land of Israel twice, once south towards Egypt in 332, and again in 331 when he marched northeast to defeat the Persians. Jews in Israel were under Greek rule beginning in 332. The Hasmonean uprising broke out in the year 167. If this is a collision course, it sure took a long time to discover that this is a collision course. In other words, why is it that we have to wait 165 years, right, for Jews and Greeks to suddenly discover that they can't get along together? Right? But it's even more problematical. And that is, the Jews of the land of Israel were ruled after Alexander the Great dies. You know, his empire was split up among his various successors. And for a century, the land of Israel was ruled by one of the successors to Alexander the Great, who ruled over Egypt. His name was Ptolemy, and the empire that was founded in Egypt was known as the Ptolemaic Empire. And they ruled over Palestine from 300 to 200, and we don't hear about any uprising, about any disturbances. And the sense we get is that things got along pretty much okay. So suddenly we realize that if this were clearly just a clash between cultures, why is it that this clash doesn't erupt under the Hellenistic Empire of the Ptolemies? They are Hellenists, right? As much as anyone else. And yet, in the year 200, now the Ptolemies are centered in Egypt, the Seleucid Empire, other great Hellenistic empire of the east, of the Middle East, is the Seleucid Empire, named after Seleucus, one of the other generals of Alexander the Great. They will conquer the land of Israel in the year 200, and within 30 years, there's a Hasmonean uprising. The Hasmonean uprising erupted in the year 167 BCE. Now, that raises a question. In other words, is it a clash of cultures, or is there something else going on here that might have brought about some, right, turmoil, some sort of, what shall I say, anxiety in the geopolitical situation of the Middle East that brought about this uprising. And sure enough, we know that that's what happened. And this is the first thing we should learn. Whenever we deal with events, we have a tendency as Jews to understand the events kind of with an insular type of mentality. In other words, what did Jews do? What did people do to Jews? We forget sometimes that what people might be doing to Jews is part of a much larger context of what existed at the time and what might have aroused or the needs of the empire that happened to rule over Jews but ruled over others at the same time. And sure enough, something very interesting happens. In the year 200, the land of Israel was conquered by the Syrian Greek Empire, and in fact, the king was none other than the father of the wicked Antiochus. This king is known as Antiochus III, who is benevolent to the Jews. He arrives in Jerusalem, and he actually thanks the Jews for a wonderful a reception that they gave him, so much so that he actually declared that the law of this land, and this was a declaration that he issued in the year 200, would be, anybody here read Greek by any chance, right? That the law of the land would be tatus patrios nomos. Katatus patrios nomos in Greek, the law of the land will be according to the laws of the fathers. In the year 200, the Greek king who ruled over Palestine, Antiochus III was his name, decreed that the Torah would be the law of the land, which makes our riddle even greater. In the year 200, the Greeks announced that the law of Israel would be the Torah. 33 years later, we have a major Jewish uprising against the Greeks. What happened? And so suddenly we realize that the kindergarten story needs a little more, a little more meat to it to fill in the missing facts. And we know what the missing facts were. Here, major events took place. 10 years after the Syrians conquered Israel, they themselves were delivered a tremendous blow by the new enemy of the Eastern Hellenistic world, the Greek world of the East, Rome. The Roman Republic would begin to make inroads into the Near East precisely at this time. They defeated the Syrians in Asia Minor in Turkey. And this was in the year 190-188. As a result, the Seleucid Empire was forced to pay taxes to the Romans, to give back conquered territory to the Romans, to even send hostages of the royal family to Rome so it should be on its good behavior. And sure enough, one of the hostages was our buddy Antiochus IV, and he's the son of the king, was sent off to Rome as a hostage. Syrians from that moment on are looking over their shoulders. They realize that the days of the glory of the Hellenistic world of the East, the heritage of Alexander the Great is now in danger of being conquered by the barbarians of the West. And who are the barbarians of the West? Roman Empire. The main turning point would be in the year 175. In the year 175, that hostage, the son of the king, Antiochus IV, comes back to Syria and assumes the monarchy. And he becomes king of a vast, vast kingdom spreading from Syria, Persia, even to the borders of Afghanistan and Pakistan and India, but Palestine as well. And he knows one thing, that his days are numbered unless he can unify all of the old kingdom of the great. Now, what is the other kingdom of the Hellenistic East at the time? We saw Egypt. His great dream is to present a uniform, unified kingdom in the East that will prevent the Romans from conquering, as it were, or washing over all of that area. So his great dream is to march on Egypt. Now, think for a moment. If you are in Syria and you are going to march on Egypt, there's a little to pass through. Right? A little sliver of land in between that you want at all costs to be what? Quiet, not to make trouble, not to stir anything up. And that little land called, well, whatever you want to call it, Judea, Palestine, Israel, right? Whatever we want to call it. And so what does Antiochus do? He's looking for support within the land. He's looking for people that will maintain the land, loyal, quiet, during that great expedition. And lo and behold, there are a few Jews in Jerusalem willing to go along with his plans. One of them happened to be the brother of the high priest. The high priest at that time was by the name of Onias. He had a brother named Jason. Well, kind of tells you something. Jason, Yason. Not Jason, Yason. Yeah, not, you know, think at his bris, at, you know. We don't know. We don't know. Yason, Yehoshua, I don't know. But imagine that at his bris, his father called him Jason. You know, ugh. No, no, no. That grave, he's talking. We found right near my house, right near where I live, there's a very impressive Greek, Jewish, a grave site, literally dating back to the second century. We don't know anything about. The fellow's name is Jason, but it's another Jason. I like to joke that he must have been a very rich Sadducee who lived in Jerusalem at the time. Why? Who else could buy land in Rehavia for a grave? Right? Wealthy, that's the neighborhood in Jerusalem, right? So he must have been very wealthy. But this fellow Jason turns to the king and says, you know, if you appoint me high priest instead of my brother, I can consolidate things for you. I will consolidate things for you so that when you march off to Egypt, things will be quiet. The king goes along with the plan. Jason becomes high priest and he goes a step further. And Jason is kind of what we would call a moderate Hellenist, right? This is kind of the equal of moderate terrorist, whatever that means, right? You know, in other words, he's willing to play along with the needs of the government, and he does something very interesting. And I have to make a long story short here. He turns Jerusalem into what was happening throughout the Greek world into a Greek city called Antioch. Now, you have to understand, this doesn't mean rebuilding the city. What does it mean? It means introducing certain institutions into the city. For instance, the educational institution in a Greek city is known as the gymnasium. And so he builds a gymnasium in Jerusalem. He builds a theater. We hear of athletic games introduced into the city. Now, it's interesting to introduce this, right? It is this new high priest who looks upon this as a consolidating support for the king as he's about to embark on his expedition. In fact, I always imagined, and this one of the books that I'll refer to in a minute, I always imagined two young priests, you know, walking up to the temple and they walk by the athletic games and one of them says to his friend, you know, this abomination going on over there, it's disgusting. You believe what they're doing there. They're participating in throwing the javelin and the disc. And I got to tell you, they're not overdressed when they do this. And in fact, not only are they not overdressed when they do it, but some of them are so embarrassed that they try to hide the signs of their Jewishness there's a word in Greek for this, hiding your circumcision, right? And it's disgusting. You must see it, right? and there's a certain group dynamic here, and people are interested. They're kind of, you know, they don't know how to relate to this, but it's there. Sure enough, after Jason, you know, does his bit, he's outbid for the priesthood by a more extreme Hellenist, a fellow by the name of Menelaus. And you see what's happening here. And this is an important point. There are apparently in Jerusalem a few career-oriented scoundrels who happen to have been born as priests, who are interested in advancing themselves, and what they're doing is they're using the political realities that have cropped up now to advance their own careers. Why do I make this point? Because it will be a mistake to imagine that you have whole groups of Jews that are now becoming, right, privy to Hellenism, who want to embark on this great new path of what? Of a cultural reform. This is a misrepresentation of the story. What you have are some Jews, and I use the word scoundrels very carefully, who apparently see this as what? As a occasion for advancing their own personal careers, as it were. Antiochus sees that the city is in his hands. He marches off in the year 168 to conquer Egypt. He actually tried in 169. He was unsuccessful. But now comes the best part of the story, and I have to make it quick. I'm going to the second half of my talk. He gets to Egypt, conquers almost all of the land, and understand, if he can conquer Egypt, if he can conquer the city of Alexandria, what does Antiochus become? The new Alexander the Great. He's united the Middle East. He's at the gates of Alexandria. It's June of the year 168. And the Romans hear of this, and they know that they have to prevent this at all costs. And there's a beautiful story in Greek historiography. They send a Roman delegate, Roman Shaliach, who issues a very blunt ultimatum to Antiochus. You have no business being here. Go home. Antiochus says, I'll think about it. And the Roman takes his staff out and he draws a circle around Antiochus and he says, you'll think about it here, inside this circle. And huh? And tauta buleo, two words in Greek, think about it in here. Antiochus thinks about it, and he turns around, and he goes home. Because he knows that the balance of power has shifted, and Rome defeated his father just a few years ago. It can do the same thing to him. You're a Jew, you're living in Israel, and what do you suddenly see? The Greek army is in retreat, going back to Syria. What conclusion do you draw? They've been defeated. They've been embarrassed on the battlefield. Maybe we can reassert ourselves now in Jerusalem and undo this reform that took place a few years ago, right? Suddenly, who marches back to Jerusalem? That great Jewish prophet, Jason, right, who had been outbought for the high priesthood, but now he becomes the banner of true Judaism, right? And there's a mini rebellion in the city of Jerusalem. Now, if you're Antiochus, let's play psycho history. What's your state of mind at this time? What do you imagine? I mean, how do you feel after what happened in Alexandria? Terrible what? Right, the circle. And in other words, your frame of mind is not too good even before the disturbances in Jerusalem. You've been embarrassed. This wasn't the defeat on the battlefield. It's 10 times worse. Right? You've been humiliated. You had to turn around and go home. And in the midst of your humiliation, what happens? These Jews in Jerusalem start causing disturbances in the city. He hears about this. He asks men. Now, the question is, which men? Jews or non-Jews? I wish I knew. What's happening here? And they tell him, yeah, the Jews have this religious proclivity that caused them, because you realize, well, this is pouring salt on his wounds at the worst possible time, what these Jews were doing. And now somebody explains to Antiochus, you know, it's their Jewish craziness that caused them to this mini revolt in Jerusalem. To which Antiochus seems to conclude, well, if it's a religious proclivity that caused this, this can be resolved. How? By outlawing it. And so he issues decrees against the Jewish religion, and a reaction to those decrees will be the uprising of Mattathias, Judah Maccabee, and his sons. I don't know if you realize what I've just done. I've turned this story upside down. We always imagined that what? That what started it was a Greek king with terrible decrees, and Jews reacted to the decrees. But if the presentation I gave you is correct, and I'm following a well-known historian in Jerusalem in the 1950s, Victor Cherikover, and you could read in English what I just presented to you in a book called Hellenistic Civilization and the Jews by Victor Cherikover. What Cherikover says is the sequence is just the opposite. That in fact, there must have been a Jewish rebellion to which Antiochus reacted. Now, if that's the case, we've solved something very important. What was my first line here today? That the Hellenistic world basically tolerant. In other words, it does not make sense that Antiochus would come to this weird idea of what? Of bringing us to the Olympus of Greek culture. culture, saving our souls by taking us into good Greeks. When would he inflict persecution? If it suited his political needs. In other words, it was not an attempt to do what? To reform Judaism, right? To reinvent Judaism as part of the Hellenistic world. It was a means of assuming political quiet. But the Jews, and that's why the suppression of that uprising in Jerusalem, to which Mattathias and his sons react with the uprising. You have to understand what we've gained by this. First of all, we've contextualized it. We've put it into some sort of a framework that makes a lot more sense. But of course, what we've also done is we've done away with this idea that, you know, Jews only rebel when somebody hits them over the head, right, and something. And now we see suddenly that there was a Jewish rebellion, apparently, even before the declaration, the decrees of Antiochus Epiphanes. In other words, Jews were active, or proactive, if you wish, arousing Antiochus to react, thereabout bringing about a greater Jewish reaction. But I want to go further. Yes, please. Let's be more precise now. I don't know if I want to go as far as what is very often claimed, a civil war. I don't think that we have two camps here, the camps of the traditionalist Jews and a camp of Jewish Hellenists, and they're fighting out. We love to believe that that's what happened, right? But in fact, I think that the people who, in other words, the vast majority were simple Jews who didn't belong to the camp, right? Were a few of these high priestly types who apparently realize that they have a great advantage by going along with the Greek side. They would be opposed by other priests like Mattathias who are not willing to go along with this. No, I want to make this point clear, and I'll tell you why. Because historiography of the late 19th and early 20th century, mostly Christian historiography, was very interested in not only following up what you just said, but the great Christian historian, Shearer was his name, wrote a book, A History of the Jewish People in the Time of Jesus. And when he begins the Hasmonean War, he starts with this line, and I'm going to almost quote it verbatim now. He says, at the time, the vast majority of Jews were already in the Hellenistic camp. The traditionalists were about to become a sect. And this would have basically brought about what? The end of traditional Judaism. What went wrong, he says? The foolishness of a despot by the name of Antiochus Epiphanes, who couldn't wait for the process to take its natural course and tried to push it fast ahead too quickly, that his foolishness brought about, right, in other words, enacting this persecution, brought about the reaction of Mattathias, which was the Hasmonean uprising. Were it not for this persecution, right, what would have happened to Judaism? It would have all become Hellenized. Do you realize that if Shearer is correct, who should be the hero of next year's Hanukkah celebration? Instead of feeding and celebrating Mattathias and Judah Maccabee and his brothers, who is our champion? Who's the hero? Antiochus IV Epiphanes. He saved Judaism, according to Shearer. Now, you have to realize why Christian historiography was very interested in this, because the big question was, where does Christianity come from? And you know, there's a great element of Hellenism in early Christianity, and this was the solutions. In other words, this way you don't have to go to the diaspora to find the roots of Christianity. You can say the roots of Christianity were already in the land of Israel among Jews at the time. Yes? Very good. I will get to that. I'll get to that in a minute. That's my next. That goes to the question of sources. Exactly. It's an excellent question. Would that I could ask Mattathias that question. Now, where shall I have to go to reach an answer to your question? To the sources. Of course, now my question will be, who wrote the sources and why? And this is critical. And this is, now I'd like you to look at the pages you have in front of you. Now, we have an interesting here. And that is, the Maccabean episode has two stages to it. The first stage is this stage, the stage that begins in the year 167 with the uprising. Hanukkah, by the way. Purification of the temple takes place 3 years later in 164, so you should know this date. December 164 is when BCE is when Hanukkah takes over. Then there is a period of about 25 years from 164 and until 141 where Judah Maccabee and his brothers are still kind of consolidating their position. It's not independence yet, but they're It's sort of a state in the making, where they're getting more and more power. Beginning in the year 141, and this is what I wrote here, the second stage of the Hasmonean period begins a state, an independent Jewish state that existed from 141 till 63 BC when the Romans conquered Judea. Now, I spoke at the very beginning of how things are shaped in our minds. Something very interesting happens with these two stages. The first stage is considered to be, quote, the good stage. Everybody likes Mattathias. Everybody likes Judah Maccabee. They're in the national consensus. They're the good guys. Jews like them. Christians like them. Everybody likes them. There's lots of artwork about these guys, right? When the Hasmonean state takes over, what is the image? And I don't know how much you know about these guys. The Hasmonean kings like Alexander Jannaeus, John Hyrcanus. What is the image that they very often project? Does anyone know? Oh, perfect. That's the classic image that we have. They all go downhill. The good guys were wonderful. The first guys were wonderful. The later guys are all what? They've lost their path. They've lost their direction. They become heavies. They become the bad guys. They're killing everybody all over the place, including Jews, right? There's this great dichotomy that exists, right, between the first pure stage and the second impure stage, right? The latter state is the bad thing. I'm going to show you now how all of this is the result of what? Of the two things I spoke about before. The sources that we have and the ideologies that shape our imagery. And this is what we have to be careful of. This is my point. Don't let other people tell you how to think about things. Read these sources independently. Realize who's writing. Now, for the first stage, this stage, the war, the uprising, we have one major source. The books of Maccabees. These are books that were written by Jews, in particular two books, 1 Maccabees and 2 Maccabees, books that were written a little after the events. They were written, one of them was written in Hebrew, good biblical Hebrew, in Israel. That's 1 Maccabees. The second book was written by a Jew living in the Greek diaspora in North Africa, and at 2 Maccabees. These books were not preserved by Jews. You know this. They became part of the Greek Bible. They are preserved in the Greek Bible known as the Septuagint, the translation by the 70. And it was the church that preserved them. The church was at one time very happy with these books. For instance, the second book of Maccabees tells stories about martyrdom. In fact, it's in the second book of Maccabees that we encounter a story that you all know, the mother and her 7 children, right? The Greek king wants to impose idolatry, and each of 7 children are willing to meet their death. The first real organized martyrdom we encounter is in the second book of Maccabees. So the church liked a book like that because martyrdom resonated very much in the church's mind. And also it looked like a good war against, paganism. But if you look at the book of Maccabees, and in particular 1 Maccabees, which is the most important source that we have, you'll find something very interesting. This book was written with a purpose. And the purpose, what we know about the events. What do I mean? First of all, whoever wrote this book of Maccabees clearly shaped his book after the Torah, after the Bible. He begins, and it came to be after the days of Alexander the Great. By the way, I don't know how good your biblical Hebrew is, but we have this book in Greek. The first 10 sentences all begin with the same word. In Greek, the word kai. The word kai can be translated into English as and. And it came, and now this is horrible Greek. When I was a child, I was told that in English you never start a sentence with and, right? Now everything is already forgotten, right? But when we grew up, we were told never start a sentence with and, right? But of course, this was once in Hebrew. And the in Hebrew all began with vayehi, vav, and this vav, and so clearly you can see it. But if you're not convinced, the last line of the book is, and all the other deeds of Hyrcanus and all of his successes, behold, they are written on the books of blah, 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 blah. This is exactly right out of the book of Chronicles. In other words, 1 Maccabees does something. First of all, he's suggesting to you, this is like a book of the Bible. But not only that, He describes the events in a very interesting way. Now look at the sources that you have in front of you. This is a wonderful example. Do you know what the first story is in the book of Maccabees in 1 Maccabees? This is part of the kindergarten story. You're supposed to know this, right? How does the war begin? The evil king wants all the Jews to become Greeks, and so he has altars set up throughout the country. And one of the places where an altar is set up is the little townlet of Modi'in, right? Not far from Jerusalem. It's about a half hour, like, or chariot, maybe 45 minutes, right? Near the airport, right? Not far from the airport. Lud, the area of Lud Modi'in. Now there's a city, Modi'in, right? Ah, really? Yeah. And Modi'in is somewhere in that general area. By the way, in building that modern city of Modi'in, we found a number of antiquities, and I got personally into fights because they weren't willing to preserve some of them. They were so anxious to set this city up that a lot of the sites were actually destroyed. We were very angry. It was terrible. Of course it's and so the story there in 1 Maccabees is what? That a Greek officer comes to the city of Modi'in, sets up an altar, and asks, will anybody worship? He's trying to what? Induce Jews to abandon their tradition, go over to another tradition. But of course, no Jew would do this. Until, now look at the source. In other words, the Greek had spoken. And then Mattathias basically says nobody should do this. When he had finished speaking these words, a Jew came forward. Do you have it in front of you? You see the source I'm reading? A Jew came forward in the sight of all to offer sacrifice on the altar in Modi'in. And according to the king's command. In other words, we have a Jew who's going to go over to the other side. What does Mattathias do? When Mattathias saw it, he burned with zeal. His heart was stirred. He gave vent to righteous anger. He ran and he killed him on the altar. Not only that, at the same time he killed the king's officer who was forcing them to sacrifice. He tore down the altar. He burned with zeal for the world. What is this? Does this... Excellent. Perfect. And for those who haven't got it, I'll explain. What is the story? The story tells how somebody from the outside is about to entice a Jew, but the righteous Jew is burning with zeal, so the righteous Jew comes running up and he slays whom? Both of them. The enticer from the outside and the renegade Jew from the inside. All you have to do, and this is why I asked two people did this for me today, right? Brought me a Bible. All you have to do is open up the book of Numbers, which you don't have in front of you, but let me just read this for you, right? In the book of Numbers, chapter 26, right? We are told that the people of Israel were in the desert, and the Moabites come along, and behold, a man of the children of Israel wanted to have relations with a Midianite woman. It's about to be a renegade Jew to have some sort of sexual relation with a foreign woman. And the people were weeping. And who saves the day? Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the Kohen, stood up and he took a spear and he followed the man into the tent, pierced them both, the Israelite and the woman into her stomach, right? And then God said to Moses, Phinehas, turn back my wrath when he zealously avenged my vengeance. He was zealous. And the word zealous appears in the Bible, bekano et kinati, and the word kina appears 5-6 times. Sure enough, in the book of Maccabees, the same word appears 5-6 times. What is the author of the book of Maccabees doing? He's presenting Mattathias like Phinehas. Why? Not only both were priests. What does the Bible say? This is the point. Because of Phinehas' zeal, he became the priest. Ultimately the high priest. What is the book of Maccabees about? Were the Hasmoneans high priests? No. But when you this gets them there. In other words, this book will serve... will serve as the you call it the Heksher, the legitimization. In other words, you can look high and low in the book of Maccabees to find something wrong with the Hasmoneans. Don't find it. Why? because they wrote the book, right? In other words, or if they didn't write the book, they commissioned the book. And the whole book, now it's so fascinating. The word zeal appears here 6 or 7 times in the first book of Maccabees when Josephus Flavius, hundreds of years later, copies the book. And I wrote an article showing how Josephus copies this book word by word, line by line. Every time he gets to the word zeal, zealotry, what does he do? He jumps over the word. He never uses it. Why? Because he's, in his day, there's a group out there calling themselves the zealots. But Josephus, they're the bad guys. You see what I'm suggesting here? Sources, you got to be very careful. Whether it's one Maccabees talking about, right, about the Maccabees, whether it's Josephus talking about one Maccabees, right? Everybody's playing with his own ulterior motive here, and we have to know how to read these sources. The book itself is amazing, but it leaves you with no doubt that and let me give you another example, and this is on the same page in front of you. And by the way, if you haven't gotten the idea yet, look at the first source that we were reading, right? And so he burned with zeal for the law, just as Phinehas did against Zimri, son of Salu, if you haven't caught the idea yet. Then Mattathias cried out, let everyone who is zealous for the law, blah, 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 come and support me. And I'm skipping to line 50. Now my children show zeal, blah, blah, blah. Now what is this? Mattathias is about to die. He's on his deathbed. And he gives his sons a lesson in Jewish history. And if they haven't gotten the point, look at scripture number 54. Phinehas, our ancestor, right? He's talking to his sons on his deathbed. Our ancestor, because he was deeply zealous, received the covenant of everlasting priesthood. You realize what's happening here. In other words, what is he suggesting? Ergo, we shall now receive everlasting priesthood. If you haven't gotten the point, my favorite story to prove how tendentious one Maccabees is, and so how careful we have to be, is look at this source here on the same page, number 2. And the source is very interesting. We'll run out of time if I don't hurry. What does the story say? As Mattathias dies and Judah Maccabee takes over. Judah Maccabee successes all over the place, right? He can do no wrong. And two little minor soldiers, or rather minor officers in the Jewish army, are a little jealous. Why should he be getting all the credit? Let's instigate a little battle ourselves, and we'll go off to war, and then we'll get a little credit. So they do it. They instigate a little battle, and of course, sure enough, they fail. Now, let me ask you, if you fail in battle, and somebody's writing the history of the battle, what reasons are usually given for failing in battle? You didn't have the right weapons, you didn't have good military intelligence, you didn't have good army discipline, you know, I mean, that's right. The author of 1 Maccabees knows why they failed. Look at line 62, but right on the very bottom. But they did not belong to the family of those men through whom deliverance was given to Israel. Why did they fail? They come from the wrong mishpocha. Right. In other words, this is an issue of mishpacha, right? If you come from the right mishpacha, you'll be victorious. So you see my problem. In other words, this period has this halo of being all wonderful because the sources that we know about the period are written, or if you want, commissioned by the people who are projecting it. And then something very interesting happens. We come to this period. But for this period, we have no Book of Maccabees. The Book of Maccabees ends down here, or up here actually it ends, at the very beginning. And for the state, we have no real Jewish source.
Okay.
Yeah, yes, very quickly, yes.
If the Phinehas, the issue is discussed in Sanhedrin,
oh.
The rabbis do not like the whole concept. Are the rabbis discussing Phinehas, or are they discussing
excellent.
Yanai and his...
No, the rabbis talk about Phinehas and they're not happy. But you know why the rabbis don't like Phinehas? Not because he's a lot, but because before going off to kill these two Jews, he didn't come to the local Beis Din, right, and ask the local rabbi, should I or shouldn't I do it? Mm-hmm. The rabbis were upset with the fact that what is he doing? He's not asking. He never asks Moses. Moses, for them, was the prototype of the rabbinic sage, right? He's Moshe Rabbeinu. So they get very upset with Phinehas. But you see the point here. Everybody who describes this has their own motivation for discussing the issues here, and we have to realize this. Yes. Well, you know what? I don't want to call one Maccabees anti-rabbinic. That may be going a bit too far. He's certainly a religious man, but he kind of tells God, sit aside, you know. And, you know, two Maccabees is very religious, but he's written outside. You know, he's a Jew of the diaspora. They don't know. It's very interesting. One Maccabees was written, you know, by the IDF, commissioned by the Hasmoneans, everything. We win the war. We're victorious. You go to two Maccabees, you go outside, it's Hanukkah. It's, you know, it's much more. Everything is religious. The guy wears his religion on his sleeve. Literally, there are apparitions, angels, miracles all over the place. And it's very interesting. One Maccabees is a very militaristic book. Let's go and fight the war and be victorious. Josephus Flavius is writing after the destruction of the Second Temple, and he quotes One Maccabees as having Judah say, let's be willing to give up our life for our law, and so on. And you see how things have changed. In other words, from the activist, you know, kind of Zionist type of the Second Temple period, the Maccabean type, you come to a much more, pacifist and pacifist and religious willingness to die. Everybody's telling the same story differently, which now, of course, you realize why the story of the candles resonated much later, so much more than the war stories, because when you come to the ages, the war stories don't have the same effect that a miracle will have on many people. Maybe we'll talk about that later. I don't know if I have time. Now, it's very interesting when Josephus gets to the story of the Maccabees, and this is what you said before, everything goes downhill. Why does it go downhill? It goes downhill because the sources before Josephus were all Greek sources. And they, a priori, had a negative attitude towards the Hasmoneans for the simple idea. What were the Hasmoneans? What were the Hasmonean kings doing? They were conquering territory that had become Hellenized, and they were reverting it back to what? To Oriental, right? To monotheistic, or Jewish. In Greek eyes, this is antithetical to what culture is all about. And they are the only sources we have for the Hasmonean state. So you see what my problem is. The good guys are so wonderfully good because the only sources we have were actually produced by them. The last guys are so terribly bad because our sources are what? Are, from their very nature, anti-Hasmonean. Let me give you an example of how funny these sources can be sometimes. And this is just one example. It can happen when you don't know who's writing the sources. And this, put this here. Josephus writes about one of the Hasmonean kings. His name is Aristobulus. And let me you don't have this in front of you. Let me just read it for you. He says the following about this fellow Aristobulus. Aristobulus ruled for only 1 year, from 104 to 103 BC. Of his brothers, loved only Pigonus, who was next to him in age, and considered him worthy of a position like his own. All his other brothers he put in charge. In other words, he put all of his brothers in jail. He also imprisoned his mother, who disputed royal power with him. This guy is something of a tachshit. That's a real nice guy, right? He put all his brothers in jail. He put his mother in jail, right? He carried his cruelty so far that he caused her to die of starvation in prison. So now it's matricide, right? Right. To the death of his mother, he added that of Antigonus. The only brother he loved, he had him killed also. Right? I think what emerges is, right, a very definite description of this Hasmonean king. You skip a few lines and you get to Josephus' summary of this fellow Aristobulus. And this is how he sums him up. He had a kindly nature, was wholly given to modesty. As Strabo testifies, this man was a kindly person, very serviceable to the Jews. My God, what's going on here? You know, five lines earlier, the guy's killing his whole family, right? You go to the bottom of the page and he's a nice old guy, right? He's a kindly nature. What do you have? Two different sources. Suddenly, the first source was the source that Josephus uses all the time, and it's anti-Hasmonean from day one. But suddenly, fell into his hands another source, which seems to have been objective. And what does he do, Josephus? He's like my students at the university. You have an extra file card, You're writing a seminar paper. You're going to get to the paper. It may contradict. It may not fit. It's going to get in because the professor has to know that you saw this source, right? And Josephus sometimes does the same thing. But now, so you realize, yes. That's what's so amazing. He claims that they're his champions, right? But he doesn't go along with their militaristic approach. Look, he had problems. Actually, I alluded to this, if I'm not mistaken, in a lecture I gave here a couple of years ago. Josephus read 1 Maccabees, where Judah Maccabees is beating the Greeks. Now, Judah Maccabee makes speeches in 1 Maccabees all the time. His soldiers are scared out of their mind. You know, they see the Greek army opposite them, and what are they? They're a few hundred farmers, right? Judah makes speeches, and what does he say? Don't fear, it's God's power that the few can defeat the many. Let's put our faith in God. Josephus sees this, but he has a problem, because you all know that Josephus, in the end, becomes the great opponent to the zealots of his day, and he makes speeches telling the people of his day to put down their arms. And what does he say to them? Can't defeat the Romans. They outnumber us. But now you realize what Josephus' problem is. Judah Maccabee was his ancestor and hero. Judah Maccabee tells his soldiers, have faith in God. God can have the few defeat the many. What's he going to do? If he quotes that speech, he's making a joke of his own speeches, telling the people of his day not to fight, because they'll answer, what do you mean? They did it, we can do it. So what does Josephus do? He amends the text slightly. And instead of Judah saying to his soldiers, have no fear, it's in God's power that the few can defeat the many, he adds a little something. Have no fear, it's in God's power that the few can defeat the many if the few are righteous. Right, and he solved everything. Right, the Maccabees in times of yore were tzaddikim, hence they were victorious. Zealots today are brigands; they are crooks, they're criminals. They'll never be victorious. So you see what historical revisionism is all about, right? You can play fast and loose with the sources, and this is what we know about the Hasmoneans, right? So you realize what we're living with. We're living with sources that are so tendentious that do we really know, or can we really know what happened? I have questions.
Didn't he write his book of the Milchama?
Against the Romans. Of course, he was also afraid of the Romans at the time. Yeah, but this rewriting he does many, many years later in a second book of his known as Antiquities, where he is much freer to talk even against the Romans. But, and now we have to finish. What shaped our opinion about the Hasmoneans and gave us maybe a positive image of this period, but a negative image of this period, was not only the sources. It was also subsequent ideologies. Notice when this is taking place, literally, the last century before the Christian era. And as a result, the Hasmonean state found itself playing a very uncomfortable role in the history of Christianity as well. I would like to read for you a text that was written by a British historian of the early 20th century. His name was Bevin. There was another famous Bevin who was a British foreign minister, but we're not going into that. This guy, Ernest Bevin, wrote a book called Jerusalem Under the High Priest. He wrote it in 1904. And he describes what happens to the Hasmonean state. Now listen to the tone of his description. And he's a historian. It appears to me a question whether it was not at spiritual cost that the Jewish people allowed itself to be launched by the sons of Hashmon upon a career of carnal strife. In other words, look what happened to these Jews. They allowed themselves to be led by the Hashmonaim, the Hasmoneans, into what? Carnal strife, meaning shedding blood, right? Vicious behavior. What? Now, what's bothering him? Listen, gets better. For the Jewish community could not be amenable to the same laws as ordinary nations. It was more like a church, and the laws of a church's life were to that degree the true laws of its being. In other words, what bothers Bevin? That the Jews were doing what? They were fighting. That they put an army together. They were willing to carve out a state. And he says, this is Judaism? Judaism should be spiritual, right? In other words, it should be, and of course you realize now why he's writing this. Because if you're a Christian, what do you have, and you claim that you're Israel, what do you have to put your finger on? Where did Israel go wrong? Where did it go astray? And if you can put your finger and say, here's where it went astray, and now the corrective has to take place, and so you see what's happening. Look how he describes the Hasmonean state. Under the blast of Jewish conquests, civilization in Palestine withered away. Now that is a double-edged sword here. Civilization was probably something that the Greeks already said. In other words, if you take a Greek city and turn it back into a Jewish city, you're undoing civilization, because what is the word civilization? I'm sure you know this. The word civilization comes from the word civis in Latin. Civis is also the same root of the word city. City and civilization, in Greek mentality, culture, civilization comes from the city. If Alexander Janaeus, the Hasmonean king, captures a Greek city and turns it into a Jewish city, he's undoing civilization. But of course, Bevan takes it much further. Where there had been prosperous cities were heaps of ruins. Fields went back to brushwood. Roaming bands of marauders had free course in the land. Such a state of things marked the zenith of Hasmonean